and welcome to Superbugs and You, true stories from scientists and patients around the world. This podcast series explores the threat of antimicrobial resistance, which occurs when bacteria, viruses, fungi, and parasites change over time and no longer respond to antibiotics and other medicines. In other words, they become superbugs. I am Dr. Marnie Peterson, and I've spent the last 25 years focused on this topic, both as an educator and researcher, and I will be your host.
It's not the vaccine in the bottle that saves lives, but actually vaccination. Getting that vaccine to populations is what reduces disease and saves lives.
Infection prevention is key to slowing antimicrobial resistance. If one does not get sick, then antibiotics are not needed. Over the past decade, several strains or types of Salmonella typhi have become resistant to multiple antibiotics. One recently emerging strain, known as extensively drug-resistant or XDR Salmonella typhi, is resistant to all but two antibiotic classes recommended for treatment. Since 2016, an ongoing outbreak of XDR typhoid fever has sickened more than 5,000 people in Pakistan and 11 children in the United States who traveled to or from that region. Resistant strains have been identified across the globe. However, the 2018 launch of a vaccine has slowed infections. The introduction of routine immunization of typhoid conjugate vaccine, or TCV, at age 9 months, with a catch-up campaign up to age 15 years, was predicted to avert 46 to 74% of all typhoid fever cases in 73 countries. This episode will cover the impact of these vaccinations and the challenges to deploy these effective programs.
I am Dr. Farhanaz Kamar. I am a consultant pediatric infectious disease and an associate professor at the Department of Pediatrics and Child Health in Medical College, Pakistan. I have the position of an endowed chair at the university, and I have been serving several roles, both nationally and internationally, as part of the typhoid committees within the WHO, as part of the antimicrobial resistance programs.
You've had a strong interest in Salmonella typhi. For listeners that don't understand, why would today we be talking about Salmonella typhi? What type of infection does it cause? And what are some of the challenges in Pakistan with this particular organism?
The interest in Salmonella typhi is also due to the endemicity of this infection. This infection is so common in Pakistan that in every clinic you see several patients, and not just me, all even general pediatricians throughout the country. We see cases of febrile illness, which are due to typhoid. And typhoid is a disease caused by the bacterium Salmonella typhi. And most cases present with high-grade fever, constipation, and diarrhea. Some have vomiting, poor appetite, body aches. And this bacteria is transmitted through the fecal-oral route. And it's primarily spreads in low resource settings due to poverty, where there is unhygienic environmental condition, lack of access to safe drinking water, absence of appropriate sanitation, and neglect towards food safety and food hygiene. It's been called a disease of the poor in the past, but now with the rapid urbanization and breakdown of the urban water and sewage infrastructure, this disease now does not respect any socioeconomic boundaries and is seen in the rich and poor alike. I would say especially the role of water has been recognized in the transmission of typhoid since even the 1800s. The role of food in the transmission of disease, and in particular for Salmonella typhi, has also been recognized several centuries ago. We know that eating unsafe food, using contaminated utensils, living in unhygienic conditions, all of this favors growth and survival of microorganisms. And also we know that food cooked at inadequate temperatures, stored poorly, help to spread the disease in endemic areas. Another risk factor is street foods. We know that street foods have high microbial loads, unclean water, or the hands of people if they're unclean who are handling the food. And these people might also be the carriers for the disease, for Salmonella typhi. All of these can cause food contamination and lead to spread of the disease.
When someone were to present in your clinic, do you face any challenges in diagnosing? Or perhaps you can easily diagnose, but are you having troubles in treatment?
Challenge with Salmonella typhi is that it presents as a febrile illness. And for febrile illnesses in endemic settings, there is a challenge of diagnostics. There is poor lab infrastructure, and the only lab test that is so far up to date, the gold standard for diagnosing cases of typhoid, is blood culture. But again, even if it is available, where available blood culture, the biggest factor is the volume of blood that is needed. As you may know, is the most common in children under the age of 15 years in most endemic settings, though adults are also infected. And for adults, you need at least 10 to 15 mls of blood, and for smaller children, you need at least 3 to 5 mls of blood. If you take lower volumes, then the sensitivity decreases, and in which most often is the case. The sensitivity of blood culture itself is limited. It has a 60% chance of showing a growth of a pathogen, which is Salmonella typhi. But there are also other challenges. Like, once we obtain the test, it takes at least 5 to 7 days for the report to come back. There's a challenge of inadequate supply of the reagents and the blood culture bottles, and also of trained manpower. There are several serological tests that are available for diagnosis of typhoid, but the challenge again is low sensitivity and specificity.
What about the treatment once you have a diagnosis?
So once we have the diagnosis, in most the culture reports, the antibiotics to which the pathogen is listed down, and the physician has the option to choose amongst those antibiotics. So the antibiotics which were commonly used in Pakistan, they are still being used in other parts of the world, are relatively easily available and not very expensive. And the patient, if he or she has not developed the complications of the disease, can be easily treated with a 10 to 14 day course of the available antibiotic. If hospitalized, most of the time the preferred antibiotic is an injectable. If in the outpatient, it is an oral antibiotic. But this has now become, the treatment has become complicated and has become challenging with the emergence of the highly drug resistant isolate of Salmonella typhi that was identified in November 2016 in an outbreak in the Sindh province in Pakistan. So now this bug that was identified in 2016 is resistant to 5 common classes of antimicrobials that are used for the treatment of typhoid. For the first time, this novel bug was labeled as XDR, or extensively drug resistant Salmonella typhi. And it is sensitive to only 2 antibiotics. One of them is an injectable antibiotic, the carbapenems, and the other is an oral antibiotic, azithromycin. And the injectable antibiotic is quite expensive to use. The emergence of these drug-resistant strains has threatened the role of antibiotics in typhoid control. It has increased the treatment costs and has led to significant morbidity and mortality rates.
I want to talk a little bit about your experience as a treating physician and engaging with the families and their patients, and many of these being children. What kind of toll does this disease take on the family members and the children?
In our daily interaction with the families, the commonest concern that we face, that once a child is diagnosed with typhoid, the biggest issue is the cost of treatment. Because the antibiotics, as I said earlier, the injectable and azithromycin, and in most cases, children, when they reach to us, they're already too sick. And in most cases, in almost 60% of the cases, they need hospitalization. So the economic concerns are great, because in countries like Pakistan, the cost of illness and healthcare is born out of pocket. There is no system of health insurance by governments. There are some people who have insurances from their employers, but that's not very common. So the costs of illness have significantly increased. For example, the cost of 1 day of the injectable carbapenem or meropenem is around US dollar 80 to 90. which is huge in a country like Pakistan, where some of the people coming from the very poor settings earn just less than $15 a day. So these are catastrophic costs. And in many cases, people have had to sell their houses, sell their cattle that they own for their families. So the cost of illness and hospitalization is huge. And together with this, if any case develops complications, and with the emergence of the XDR typhoid, complications have also become very frequent. The most dreaded complication is a perforation of the gut or the intestine. And once it perforates, you need a surgery, and the costs of surgery can be huge. So if I just simply compare the costs of treatment for a typhoid that is sensitive to commonly used antibiotics versus the XDR, so for a sensitive typhoid, you would need on an average around $10 per day for treatment. For drug-resistant typhoid, as I said, anywhere between $80 to $90 per day. And for a case that has become complicated for the surgery and for the entire stay of hospitalization, it can range from $500 to $900, which is a huge cost and difficult even for the middle-income class within Pakistan. The morbidity, the mortality, and the cost of illness is all something that is extremely saddening to see in this setting.
This podcast specifically focuses on the role of vaccines to reduce antimicrobial resistance. Can you explain some of the benefits of using vaccines to fight antimicrobial resistance?
They, unlike antimicrobials, are not prone to causing resistance because they are incredibly precise to their targets, and they prevent the infections and prevent the person from falling sick, and hence prevent use of unnecessary antimicrobials. Large-scale civil engineering projects would need decades and need millions of dollars. Vaccine is the most cost-effective strategy for preventing drug-resistant infections.
I know also with the outbreak in the fall of 2016, there was a immunization campaign that was pulled together in Pakistan. So that's where I want to focus our conversation going forward. So what's your experience been like in pulling together this type of campaign for vaccination? Was the population ever hesitant to receive the vaccine?
Once we had identified XDR typhoid outbreak in Hyderabad, we engaged the Ministry of Health in Pakistan, particularly in the Sindh province, and also all of the stakeholders from the immunization program, the water and sanitation programs. But we very quickly realized that to bridge the gap until large-scale civil engineering projects are implemented, typhoid conjugate vaccines presents the most promising disease prevention option. So we started negotiating with the company, and fortunately for us, the typhoid conjugate vaccine had just been pre-qualified by WHO earlier that year. So we engaged with the company and requested them, the Bharat Biotech, to donate vaccines for the campaign, which they did. The remaining doses of the vaccine we purchased from them. We planned a huge vaccination campaign in the areas of the outbreak in Hyderabad, and we administered more than 200,000 in the doses of the vaccine. Getting the vaccine into the country and also administering the vaccine to such a large population in a very short span of time was really a challenging task, because this was a new vaccine. People had no idea of what this vaccine will do, what will it prevent. So designing all the communication materials, social mobilization, everything was challenging. But one thing that went into our favor, that because of the outbreak and also because of the endemicity of the disease, most families had seen a case of typhoid in their family. So seeing a case of typhoid, we realized, was something that made people understand that what the vaccine will do in terms of prevention, what suffering will it reduce, and what costs will it reduce. So this sort of worked in our advantage. So vaccines in Pakistan in general are given, those included in the routine immunization program, are given free of cost by the government. And this vaccine, because it was being given as an outbreak response, also was, we did not charge anything for that, and the people received it free of cost. It was a challenge to go out door to door, identify children less than 10 years of age, plan the activities, bring them to the immunization center. It was logistically very, very heavy on us, and also regarding the adverse events monitoring, because this vaccine was being used for the first time in Pakistan. And even if a single adverse event occurred, it would have had a lashback on the entire campaign. So we had to be extremely careful in giving the vaccines. So much so that during our campaign, there was also a measles outbreak, and the government announced that they will be doing a measles immunization campaign in the area of the outbreak. We stopped our vaccination campaign for that week because we did not want the new vaccine to be blamed for any inadvertent side effect that occurs because of the measles vaccine, and the campaign then gets destroyed. So we had to be extra cautious, but we were successful to administer these vaccines. We managed to control the outbreak in Hyderabad, but while we were doing this campaign, because of so much intercity travel, the outbreak had already traveled to the south and had come to Karachi. So we started seeing cases in Karachi also. So we had to launch another mass immunization campaign in the worst hit areas of Karachi. We planned a school immunization campaign this time. The communication material was all ready. We used that from that campaign. But in addition, for this campaign, we also developed a nice jingle for the typhoid vaccine. And we played this jingle inside the schools, outside the schools. And people became so, they started familiarizing with this jingle, and when they heard the jingle, they would bring their children to the camps to get themselves vaccinated. We did also announcements in the mosques after the Friday prayers. We talked to the Masjid Imams to distribute pamphlets. Whatever vaccination communication you do, it has to be culturally appropriate and it has to be acceptable. And in countries like Pakistan and in Muslim culture, there is a lot of value of the imam of the mosque. And if he communicates it in the Friday prayers, it does carry weightage. So we utilize that for communication. In addition, like, because we were doing a school campaign, and very quickly we realized that there is a large number of children who are out of school, who do not go to school. Okay. And we had to plan for a vaccination campaign to reach those children and to talk to the employers to send them for the campaign. And in schools, we had not realized that there would be older girls and their parents would refuse to get them vaccinated by a male vaccinator. So all of these things that we learned during our vaccination campaign was hugely beneficial for the government stakeholders when they introduced the vaccine in the routine immunization program of Pakistan.
Yeah, so now it's routine. Correct.
So now it's routine. Yes, now it's routine. So after all of this data that we shared, that look, we did the immunization campaign in Hyderabad and the vaccine is so effective. It's almost 90% effective, protecting 9 out of 10 children. And it has minimal side effects. All of this data was hugely beneficial, not only for the national stakeholders, but I also would say that for the international stakeholders, international community. And so when this data was shared at that time, the government stakeholders were already talking to Gavi for the introduction of the vaccine, and our data was very useful for submitting that application for Gavi funding for the introduction of the vaccine. And Pakistan then became the first country to introduce the typhoid conjugate vaccine in the immunization program. And the government did a huge vaccination campaign in November of 2019, a three-week campaign. And in those 3 weeks, 10 million children were vaccinated.
Do you think we'll be able to eliminate typhoid completely in a region?
elimination of typhoid is the would be the ultimate goal, and that would be that is really the higher aim, and we are, should all be working towards that. And I don't think that is possible only with the use of vaccine. We can reach a certain level, but we do need access to clean water and sanitation to reach that goal. We need a multi-pronged strategy and collective efforts at the national, regional, and global level to fight against antimicrobial resistance and also to work towards typhoid elimination. We need a focus on health equity, accessible healthcare, rapid diagnosis, efficient management and treatment, and targeted immunization strategies.
My name is Kathy Neusel. I direct the Center for Vaccine Development and Global Health at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. I'm a professor of medicine and pediatrics, and I trained clinically in adult infectious diseases. I've done research into vaccines my entire career, and now I'm in a position to lead a large research center, mentor early career faculty, which I really enjoy, and continue my research on vaccines.
My name is Denise Garrett. I am the vice president of the applied epidemiology team at the Sabin Vaccine Institute. I have a medical background. I worked with the CDC for 23 years as a medical epidemiologist, always with infectious diseases. And for the past 7.5 years, I've been with the Sabin Vaccine Institute working with vaccines.
Dr. Neusel and Dr. Garrett, thank you so much for joining our podcast today. Denise, I'm going to ask you the first question about your current role within the Sabin Vaccine Institute, and particularly your role and involvement in the Coalition Against Typhoid.
Absolutely. So as I mentioned, I am the vice president for the applied epidemiology team. So as the name says, we do epidemiology, we do operational research, and basically always surrounding vaccine preventable diseases. The Sabin Vaccine Institute is a non-government organization, it's an NGO, and was founded in 1993. And that was in honor to Albert Sabin. Sabin was the creator of the oral polio vaccine. And the Institute was founded to carry on his legacy. It was really with the aim to extend his life work through programs that increased access to vaccines where they're needed most. And one example is, for instance, we all know when we travel to certain areas in the world, like Africa or Asia, we all get vaccinated for diseases that are common or endemic in those places. But in a lot of times, the people living in these endemic areas, they don't have access to the vaccines that we, that don't live in these areas, are not at risk, that we have the privilege to have access when we travel to these areas. So a lot of the work that Sabin does is this, in our mission to make vaccines more accessible and to expand immunization across the globe. And the Coalition Against Typhoid came much later. It was formed in 2010 and basically is a coalition to coordinate partnerships, to convene decision makers, to advocate for sustainable solutions to typhoid.
Dr. Neusel also directs TYVAC, which is the Typhoid Vaccine Acceleration Consortium. So that's why I have both of them here today, because they're part of two different entities, if you will, but they also work together. And so, Kathy, I'd like to learn a little bit more about TYVAC for our listeners. And then I personally am curious about the part of the Typhoid Vaccine Acceleration, the acceleration piece. What does that mean to the consortium? What components of this are you trying to accelerate?
Sure. So Tyvac is a multidisciplinary and multi-partner effort to reduce the global burden of typhoid by, as you've said, accelerating the introduction of typhoid conjugate vaccines. And what we have learned from prior vaccine introductions, and Denise touched on this a little bit, that vaccines that we have here in the U.S. and in richer countries take many, many years, sometimes decades, to reach people in low and middle resource countries. So the idea is that it's not the vaccine in the bottle that saves lives, but actually vaccination, getting that vaccine to population, is what reduces disease and saves lives. So the idea here, and there have been other large vaccine acceleration consortiums. I led one for rotavirus vaccine at PATH, which is a global health not-for-profit. We've seen these for pneumococcal vaccines, for other vaccines that affect children around the world, is really that it takes a lot of convening and coordination so that the science that supports the vaccine can be translated to policymakers, to those that finance the vaccine, to those that are going to roll out and figure out how to get this vaccine to populations. And that all of that has to come together and work together in order for these countries to be able to have large, successful vaccine programs. So Tyvac generates evidence and does clinical trials and other scientific endeavors, but again, works with others to make sure that we communicate these findings, that policymakers understand these findings, and that the countries themselves can make informed decisions on vaccines.
Where in the world are these vaccines most needed? Where are you trying to get them?
In the past, we used to have typhoid pretty much all over the place. But then in the US, for instance, in Europe, this disease largely disappeared because of improved water and sanitation. So currently, the risk for infection is in the low and mid-income countries with poor access to clean water, to safe food, and to sanitation. You know, in 2023, we still have diseases affecting people. They are caused by the lack of clean water. That should be a basic right of everyone to have safe food, clean water, and sanitation. So the biggest burden of typhoid is in Asia and in the sub-Saharan Africa. So the vaccine is one of the measures, one of the preventive way to avoid typhoid. But ideally, we would like to have this population also with clean access to water, sanitation, safe food. But until we get that, vaccine is the fastest, the easiest way to protect this population against typhoid.
Just to add that rather than typhoid decreasing in many of these places, we're really worried that the opposite will happen because of population displacement and because of climate change and extreme weather events. There really is concern that while typhoid should be going away, it actually is increasing and is going to continue to increase because of these other global factors.
And we also have the issue of antimicrobial resistance now. That's a serious issue with typhoid. So I totally agree with you. We don't see it getting any better, but with all these issues, it's getting worse.
How has the increase in antimicrobial resistance affected some of the acceleration initiatives that you've been involved in? And has that also then driven the uptake of the vaccine or, you know, helped in your efforts to accelerate some of these programs?
You know, the problem with the antimicrobial resistance, as Denise said, in the early 20th century, typhoid was common, you know, in the US, in Europe, everywhere around the world. And that was before we had antibiotics. And about one out of every five people who got typhoid would die. With the introduction of antibiotics, and these were simple drugs that many of the listeners may have received, you know, sulfa drugs like Bactrim or ampicillin, some of the penicillins, those were readily treatable, but the bacteria always stayed a step ahead of us. So we would use an antibiotic, the bacteria would develop resistance. And it got to the point where fairly recently in countries such as Pakistan, we had extremely drug-resistant typhoid, where we had to use antibiotics that we use in tertiary care hospitals, for example, and in people in the ICU. And there was really only one oral option left. And this creates a real problem in these countries and where Denise was describing. The countries that have typhoid don't have access to these super antibiotics. They're quite expensive and they're just not readily available. So that really put us back to a situation where typhoid could again, you know, kill one in five children who get it because we don't have adequate antibiotics.
What are some of the biggest barriers you're seeing to vaccination globally?
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'll start with an important barrier that's been removed in many countries, and that's the financial barrier. So, you know, here in the United States, for example, we have something called the Vaccines for Children's Program. And if children are uninsured or underinsured, it's an entitlement program where they receive vaccines that are paid for by the U.S. government. Similarly, there's an organization called Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, that subsidizes vaccines for these poorest countries. Because if they had to pay market value, then that would be the single biggest barrier to introducing these vaccines. But Gavi is fully supporting typhoid conjugate vaccines campaigns in children up to 15 years of age, and then subsidizing introduction into their routine programs at a cost of 20 cents a dose. So that's a remarkable financial barrier that's been removed. However, these countries have many, many competing priorities. You know, if you're paying attention to the news, we're seeing measles outbreaks and cholera outbreaks and polio outbreaks and Ebola outbreaks. It's really difficult sometimes to put yourself in the shoes of these ministers of health, of the healthcare workers in many of these countries who are dealing with many, many other priorities that make it difficult to imagine a new vaccine introduction. But the typhoid conjugate vaccine is a single dose, and again, at a subsidized cost. And so, you know, this is where our consortium comes in to really help point out these advantages of these vaccines and help the countries strategize on how, for example, if you're doing a measles campaign anyway, let's do a measles and typhoid vaccine campaign together, right? Let's give two doses if we're going to all of that trouble of vaccinating all the children up to a certain age. So looking for ways to make this logistically easier to get this vaccine, but also other vaccines that are needed in these countries.
One other barrier that's actually where one of the areas that we work on is that some of the countries, because of the difficulty to diagnose the disease, they don't know what their burden is. So what you don't know, you can't fight, right? So if they don't know they have a high burden of typhoid in their country, simply because they don't do enough blood cultures, they don't have the capacity to diagnose the disease, so they would not be prioritizing the typhoid vaccine. And this is one of the things that we at Sabin do in collaboration with CAFI and many other partners. We try to describe the burden in several countries. So we do surveillance for typhoid, And we look at the incidence of the disease in that country to let the government and policymakers know, yes, you do have a big problem with typhoid. And in addition to that, we also look at the cost of the disease, because a lot of the policymakers, they talk cost, it's financial. So showing that the cost of having typhoid in the country is much bigger than to prevent it through implementing the vaccination in the country, because it's not only the healthcare cost, it's a disease that keeps the children off school. And also the burden of care on families and parents, the mother that has to miss days of work to take care of the sick child at home. So this is part of the work that we do in terms of showing this burden and describing this burden. We work with advocacy, translating that data in a language that policymakers will understand what the results of our research is, and also to raise awareness for typhoid. And with this, we work with a lot of in-country, there are like associations of immunizations or pediatricians or researchers. So it involves a large group of people.
Vaccines are certainly making an impact on this issue. But as you mentioned, a major source of infection is lack of clean water. How are your organizations working on this root cause?
We refer to this as WASH, water sanitation and hygiene. So it's it's improved toilet access, it's improved water, it's understanding hygiene. And we never look at typhoid conjugate vaccines as a solution in themselves, but we rather look at this integrated solution. The problem is that these WASH improvements can be slow, they can be expensive, and they also have to be maintained. So it's not a matter of just, you know, putting better piping in. If there's a damage to that pipe, it may actually cause more harm than good, because instead of a contamination being in a single well, you know, we've now spread the contamination throughout the city. So, you know, it's engineers, it's infrastructure, it's advocacy, and obviously it would carry many benefits. It would also help these other diseases. I've already mentioned cholera, where we're just having explosive epidemics right now in Africa and Asia. So it would have many benefits. But again, we're not seeing it as an either or, and it's certainly not a reason to delay introducing a vaccine.
Strengthening infrastructure, it's very costly, very complex. Although it would have a great impact on typhoid transmission, it's something that would take years, like many, many years, different from the vaccine. That's something that we can't implement now.
What is something that keeps you up at night or is a worry or a concern?
It's really related to the drug resistance for typhoid. What we have now, we have a strain in Pakistan, and Kathy mentioned it, the extreme drug resistant strain. And for that strain, we just have one oral antibiotic left to treat that bacteria. This antibiotic that's left to treat, if we lose that treatment, that means that everyone that gets typhoid cannot be treated orally anymore, and it needs to get in the hospital and get IV treatment. What would be a disaster if you consider the conditions and the hospitals and the resources there are in the countries where typhoid is endemic? And we are seeing already some increase of resistance to this specific antibiotic. And as a matter of fact, it was an antibiotic that was used in a very indiscriminate way for COVID, erroneously used. That concerns me, that we would be seeing stronger drug resistance and broader drug resistance in typhoid and lose the possibility of treating it orally.
What currently keeps me up at night is we've been working with sites in West Africa, really some of the most impoverished sites in the world. And as Denise described, they can't do blood cultures. They do not have the laboratory infrastructure. And yet children there are presenting with one of the most common complications of typhoid, which is intestinal perforation. So quite specifically, these children are coming in with holes in their gut that have to have surgical repair. And when you go and see this, as I have seen this, a 6 or a 7-year-old or an 8-year-old or sometimes even younger coming in, having to be rushed to the operating room, having to bag the children because there are no ventilators, having to operate without much anesthesia, it honestly is absolutely heartbreaking. And when I know that a single dose vaccine could prevent that, I think that would keep any of us up at night and working towards this goal.
Hello, my name is Cal McLennan. I'm a clinician scientist, an immunologist through my training, currently working as a senior program officer at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. My background is I trained as a medic and then did a PhD in neuroscience prior to then becoming interested in infection and immunity. I then went to industry and spent time in industry developing vaccines against salmonella and other bacterial pathogens. And after that, returned again to academia before moving to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I'm part of the enterocolitis and viral diseases team there. And I also have roles, keep my foothold in academia at the University of Oxford and Universities of Birmingham in relation to bacterial vaccine development. I'm the founder and director of the Back-to-Back Bacterial Vaccines Network based out of the University of Birmingham.
So you're at the Gates Foundation now. Can you tell us what your role is there and why is the foundation interested in the development of bacterial vaccines, specifically Salmonella typhi?
Yeah, sure. So my role is senior program officer for bacterial vaccines in the enteric and viral diseases team within the Gates Foundation. That's one team within the whole global health division. And my responsibilities there are to run a portfolio of vaccines against Shigella, and also against Salmonella. And I've been involved with that, with seeing vaccines come through against typhoid too. So within the team, we have two main objectives. And one is to really reduce to a low level the amount of typhoid that's occurring globally. And secondly, to bring down the, and to eliminate typhoid as being a major global health problem. And secondly, to bring down viral disease in general. Now, there are viral and bacterial pathogens responsible for enteric and viral diseases. In some ways, typhoid is something that had been waiting a long time to have an adequate vaccine against. There was proof of principle with a really good typhoid vaccine some 20, 25 years ago. And indeed, typhoid vaccines were actually used as long ago as the First World War and the Boer War. But you know, to have a vaccine that could be used globally has been something that needed a big impetus to push forward. And that was driven forward by the team I'm in to be, you know, that actually was happening when I joined the team. It was quite interesting. I ended up picking up a few typhoid conjugate vaccines at the later stage of development, but one of those was actually one I'd been involved in inventing while I was in industry. So I ended up seeing the same vaccine from two sides.
When were typhoid vaccines first developed? And how have they changed over time?
There have been typhoid vaccines for over 100 years, but the ones that we used first of all were basically wholesale killed vaccines. They were highly reactogenic, and so they really caused quite unpleasant side effects. But they were important because often in the context, for instance, of wars, you have more deaths from infectious disease, diseases such as typhoid than you might actually have from the fighting itself. So as I said, these early vaccines were used during the Boer War, during the First World War, and even Winston Churchill recounts the effects of having typhoid vaccine in his diaries. But going forward from that, there were these vaccines that had the unpleasant side effects, but there were two alternate vaccines that came forward as well. One was just the purified sugar capsule of typhoids, known as VI, the VI antigen, and that was just used as a purified polysaccharide, a purified sugar. And then the other vaccine was a what we call a live attenuated vaccine, where the vaccine was actually a strain of typhoid that through a number of passages, basically by reculturing through different media, etc., that strain became attenuated and couldn't cause disease in the same way. So those were two different vaccines that were then used over the last 20 years or so, but they had limited efficacy, particularly in young children where we really needed typhoid vaccines. And that's partly due to the immune response that's produced against a pure sugar. You don't get the same memory response, you don't get good responses full stop in children, and you don't get an improvement in the immune response in time, something that we call affinity maturation as immunologists of the immune response. But the big drawback was that you weren't getting a good response in young children and you weren't getting a memory response. And there was even some evidence with these sort of vaccines that they could reduce the number of cells that could respond to the pathogen in the course of time. And the live attenuated vaccine, again, didn't seem to be effective in children, young children under 2 years of age. And both vaccines, although they had efficacy at around the 50% level, so offering about 50% protection for 3 years, it was limited duration. And again, that problem with not being able to confer protection in youngest children. Now, the breakthrough is with a technology in vaccines known as conjugate vaccines, where what happens is that you link the sugar, which is the VI in the instance of typhoid, chemically to a protein, which is referred then as a carrier. And that gives you basically what we call a conjugate. So you've got a sugar joined to a protein, and that's then called a conjugate or a glycoconjugate vaccine. And the advantage of this sort of vaccine is that it can enlist an extra part of the immune system, which sugars on their own don't enlist. And that part of the immune system is basically the T cell arm of the immune system. But what's also important is these vaccines are able to produce good responses in children under 2 years of age. That's where they're super valuable for a lot of these bacterial diseases, which are often a problem in young children. Proof of principle was attained on that around the year 2000 by a team from NIH, vaccine developed by a team at the National Institutes of Health in the US. And the actual efficacy study was performed in Vietnam. And that showed around 70 to 80% efficacy in children, not the youngest children, but due to the lack of commercial incentive, the vaccine wasn't developed for a long time. Eventually, in the 2000s, around 2014, the first couple of typhoid conjugate vaccines became licensed, one in India, one in China, but just for use in those countries. They weren't available to be used at a more global level. And one of the things that the Gates Foundation did to help with the vaccines was to support something called a challenge model that was set up in Oxford. And this is where volunteers are challenged with the typhoid bacterium, and then the investigators look to see whether they develop typhoid or not. And that then allows you the opportunity to vaccinate people first and then see whether that offers protection or not without doing a full efficacy study in a country where typhoid's endemic. The two vaccines that have been licensed hadn't been licensed on the basis of efficacy. They'd just been licensed in terms of the immune response that they produced. And that vaccine from India, produced by a company called Bharat Biotech, was then subjected to this challenge model in Oxford. And it turned out that people who were vaccinated, volunteers who were vaccinated with that vaccine, were protected against typhoid. Then this vaccine then went on to be tested in a series of field efficacy studies in Nepal, Bangladesh, and Malawi. And those were all supported by the Gates Foundation in a consortium called TIVAC. And those studies then went on to actually show in those target populations that those typhoid conjugate vaccines were efficacious at the level of 80 to 85%. And that includes young children, as well as older children as well as adults, which is exactly what we've been looking to try and achieve with a typhoid vaccine.
Two things stand out, that it was almost 10 years since they had some proof of concept or efficacy with the conjugate vaccine until some of the challenge studies were happening. Just timing of getting things to the individuals that need them most. And then with the challenge vaccine studies, were those mostly done in adults then? And so you got that data, or were you able to test them in the target population of the pediatrics?
No, that's a very good question. And in fact, for ethical reasons, challenge studies, especially challenge studies that make people sick, can only be used in adults. You can use a challenge study where the challenge is with a vaccine strain with typhoid where you're making people sick. That has to be in consenting adults. So again, there was the challenge that you had the efficacy in those adults, but the question remained, would that translate to efficacy in young children in a low middle income country setting, which is why the Tyvac consortium was really so important, and to do those studies in the field and actually prove the efficacy of those vaccines.
Once a vaccine is developed, what is the process for getting it introduced into countries that need it? What organizations and partners come together to make that happen?
Really, the key to getting a vaccine like typhoid conjugate vaccine introduced into countries is to actually have a national introduction of those vaccines. And that's something that colleagues at the Gates Foundation are very involved with. What the WHO had been wanting these typhoid conjugate vaccines to come through for some time and had held off supporting the previous iterations of vaccines until they were available. Once the efficacy had been shown in the human challenge study in Oxford, the vaccine then went through a process of what's called WHO pre-qualification, which is a sort of sign-off that occurs at the WHO through committees that the vaccine is suitable for global health use. And a lot of countries that don't have well-developed regulatory bodies will then take that WHO pre-qualification stamp as the authority that that vaccine is a good vaccine to use. What also happened was that Gavi, which funds a lot of vaccine introductions in low middle income countries, opened a funding window for the countries to apply to introduce typhoid conjugate vaccines. So then that started to happen. And Pakistan, because it had XDR typhoid, extremely drug resistant typhoid, that drove Pakistan to be the first country to introduce. And since then, there have been introductions in around four or five other countries. And there's been a second typhoid conjugate vaccine produced by Biological E, licensed and pre-qualified as well. But the process of applying for funding has to be performed by that individual country. So countries have to make decisions on their own part and then put together an application to Gavi. And, you know, we can help countries with that. We're monitoring what's happening there. You know, we work quite closely with WHO as well in this respect. But it does take time. And that's why, even though the first typhoid conjugate vaccine was pre-qualified at the start of 2018, you know, we still have a relatively small number of countries that are introduced so far. That's partly because of the COVID pandemic as well. But it is an important aspect of any vaccine introduction, any vaccine being used. If you produce a vaccine, it's only any good if it's used. So you can't just produce, license, or even pre-qualify a vaccine. You've then got to make sure that it's actually being implemented to have effect and to save lives.
You know, we're focusing on Salmonella typhi, which is your background in their research for many years. You also are involved as director of Back2Vac, and I know you're focused on other bacteria that also have a burden of antimicrobial resistance. What other infectious diseases are you focused on? Are you thinking about relative to their overall morbidity, mortality, and maybe the antimicrobial resistance burden that they carry?
Sure. So personally, as well as Salmonella from my role at the Gates Foundation, I'm particularly focused on Shigella, which is the leading bacterial cause of diarrheal deaths. It's the main cause of dysentery. And this is a disease for which there's never really been a widespread licensed vaccine. There's a couple of vaccines in the last century that were used to a limited extent, but no longer available. What I have in terms of the portfolio that I look after at the Gates Foundation is a number of different vaccines that are that are following that glycoconjugate approach or similar approaches based on the O antigen, which is the sugar that you can use as as what we call the target antigen, the target of the immune response in Shigella. And some of those vaccines are making good progress now. So we have the prospect of those vaccines moving into late stage clinical trials during the coming years and hopefully having licensure of a first Shigella vaccine before the end of the decade. So Shigella is a big one that I'm very passionate about through my role at the Gates Foundation. In terms of bacterial pathogens, our team is very focused on cholera as well, and in particularly increasing the supply of cholera vaccine, because there just isn't enough to go around at the moment. And that's something that that we're spending quite a lot of time addressing and trying to bring new manufacturers in to produce cholera vaccine. Within the context of BactiVac, the Bacterial Vaccines Network that we set up in 2017 and now has over 1,400 members across 79 different countries, we support a whole range of vaccine development initiatives against a range of bacterial pathogens. But a big driver of the to have the network set up and for the projects we support is that antimicrobial resistance theme. And you know, there are lists of target pathogens that WHO and the Center for Disease Controls in the US put together, you know, some 5 or so years ago. More recently, the Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation have put together, actually had a go at estimating the level of antimicrobial resistant bacteria cases that are causing deaths, and then stratified those in terms of which are the which are perhaps causing the most. And the ones that are coming out consistently on top are E. coli, Escherichia coli, Staphylococcus aureus, Staph aureus, and Klebsiella pneumoniae. So those are key target pathogens for the community as a whole.
Knowing the burden of disease is really critical in trying to prioritize R&D. What role does surveillance and data play in forming these decisions about developing new vaccines?
And that's been very important to the Gates Foundation, is just understanding where the burden is and what are the pathogens that are causing the most burden. And that's led to a lot of investment from the Gates Foundation to IHME and others to perform the studies and to do the modeling and to get that perspective, so that the funds that are available, and they're limited, even though they are large, they cannot deal with everything at the same time. There has to be a prioritization exercise that goes on. And exactly as you said, you need to understand what's causing the burden to be able to know where best to put your resources.
What actions can we all take to reduce the risk of drug-resistant infections?
For most low-middle-income countries, we have to expand the access to clean water and sanitation. And for other countries, for reducing infections in healthcare settings, is important to limit the spread of superbugs. And the simplest way that this can be done is by proper hand washing.
We need to prevent infections in the first place, because fewer infections means fewer drug-resistant infections, of course. Nowadays, we see the importance of the use of the vaccine, because the vaccine will prevent infections. We will have less need to use antibiotics, and we will also help to stop the spread of resistance when it's developed.
Sometimes called antibiotic stewardship. You don't just use antibiotics when you feel unwell. You use antibiotics when that is what your physician has prescribed for you to take. Part of the driver of antimicrobial resistance is the excessive use of antibiotics, where they can be bought over the counter, which can happen in some countries, where they may be inappropriately prescribed as well. that's one thing where listeners do have might have access to antibiotics, that they only use them as they're prescribed. And if they do have a course of antibiotics to take, they take the full course, because you can imagine if you take partial courses, that can give the opportunity for bacteria to escape, to get greater transmission of bacteria with antimicrobial resistance genes.
And we need to have global public awareness campaigns to educate not just a lay public, but also physicians about the problems of drug resistance, because many of the physicians are not also aware of this. And we have to emphasize more and make this part of the infection control, antibiotic stewardship, make it part of the medical curricula for undergraduates, so that they, when they graduate out, they have an increased awareness of this and they use antibiotics cleverly.
There are many things that we can do. Obviously, vaccines are one of them. It's not just typhoid vaccines. We have other vaccines that combat bacteria that may be resistant to antibiotics, such as pneumococcal vaccines. Common vaccines such as influenza and rotavirus, which is a diarrheal vaccine, even though an antibiotic doesn't help with treating influenza, if a child goes in with fever and a runny nose, they may get an antibiotic. So if we can prevent that influenza, you know, prevent that rotavirus, prevent that COVID-19 illness, whatever it is, we're going to decrease antibiotic use.
You've been listening to Superbugs and You, a podcast series focused on true stories from scientists and patients around the world on the threat of antimicrobial resistance. This series is co-created by the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy and the Antimicrobial Resistance Fighter Coalition. The podcast is produced by Elise Holmes, Diane Flahart, and Natalie Vestine. For more news and information on antimicrobial resistance and stewardship, check out our websites, cidrap.umn.edu/ASP and antimicrobialresistancefighters.org. You can also find us on Twitter at CIDRAP_ASP and at AM Resistance.